Google wants to kill the URL, and more, coming up on today's episode of The Latest in Tech News. Hello and welcome to The Latest in Tech News podcast. I am your host, Taylor Merrick. This is the world's only 3-in-1 daily show on everything tech, gadgets, and gaming news. If you're new here, welcome. Feel free to chat with us during the live show. We'd love to hear your thoughts and make sure you click the follow button so that you can be notified when we go live. If you're tuning in via the podcast, tap that subscribe button so that you don't miss the latest show. But do keep in mind that the podcast is about a day behind and you really should be joining us over at mixer.com/technewsgadget. Finally, we are on Twitter at technewsgadget, where you can send us your questions, rants, or suggestions, both during or after the show. You guys could help me out here, Octavius, my pet octopus. Really? he felt left out, so he wanted to put some headphones on today. So for those of you watching the video, you're like, oh, what's this new headset? Yeah, Octavius is wearing a set of headphones. I'm wearing a set of headphones. It's actually a new set of headphones. It's got a mic on it. We'll see how it works out. We'll test it out, see how it goes. But Octavius is upset right now. He currently doesn't have a mic. You know what? That's just too bad for you. You know what? You never told me you wanted the one with the mic. Okay, yeah, you did tell me you wanted the one with the mic, but I said, beggars can't be choosers, so, you know, that's your choice. You didn't come with me to the store and buy it. I bought it with my own money. When you make some money, you can go out and buy it, and then you can wear whatever microphone setup, get up you want. So, Octavius will just be hanging out, chilling in the background. He's told me he still doesn't want to do Twitter, because he kind of hates the platform. So if any of you could give a convincing statement as to why Octavius should be monitoring Twitter, let us know. At Tech News Gadget, just say, hey, Octavius, this is why you should use it, or let me know in the live chat, and we'll see how it goes from there. But right now, Octavius said that he's content to sit in a live showroom and chat with you guys. So I think that covers everything. For those of you who have studied up on your tech trivia, are you ready? Because we are having some tech trivia. For those of you new here, this is something that we do every day just to test your knowledge of tech and see what you know and see if you actually know what you know or if it's just you don't. So let's set up the trivia screen here. And for those of you watching live right now, feel free to play along. And Octavius has told me that victors get points, or bytes as we call them here. So if you get the right answer, you will be awarded points. So make your vote count. Let's go ahead and set this up here. All right. Trivia is set. Let us begin. Question number 1 of 3. First question is, what computer system was the first to win a chess match against a world champion under regular time constraints? Was it A, Cray Jaguar, B, Blue Gene, C, Deep Blue, or D, Watson? Repeat that question again. What computer system was the first to win a chess match against a world champion under regular time constraints? Was it A, Cray Jaguar, B, Blue Gene, C, Deep Blue, or D, Watson? Give you guys a couple of seconds here to plug in your answers. All right, the correct answer is C, Deep Blue. IBM's Deep Blue system defeated its first world chess champion on February 10th, 1996, when Garry Kasparov lost the first game of a 6-game match. Now, he won 3 and drew the other 2 games. More than a year later, in May of 1997, Kasparov narrowly lost his 6-game rematch against an upgraded version of the machine and went as far as accusing IBM of cheating, which obviously they denied the claims. He refused a follow-up match and he retired the system. So, during its rematch with Kasparov in 1997, Deep Blue was capable of evaluating 200 million positions per second, twice as fast as the 1996 version, and was the world's 259th most powerful supercomputer. Quite impressive. So C was the correct answer there. Uh-oh. Submit and press enter. What do you mean? Ah, okay. I see I forgot to set up the trivia correctly. Okay, we'll just move on to question number 2. which is founded in 1889, Nintendo got its start by selling what product? Good thing I have some backup here. I have covered this in a past show for those of you who are regular listeners, but 1889, how did Nintendo get its start? What product did it sell? You guys type in your answer in the chat here and we'll see what we get. The correct answer is playing cards, founded as Nintendo Kappei by Fusajiro Hamuchi in September 1889 in Kyoto, Japan. The company began by producing and marketing handful playing cards, which had existed in different forms for centuries, but fell out of popularity following restrictions on gambling. And so you're wondering, well, how in the world did you start on the video games? Well, in 1975, Nintendo acquired the Japanese distribution rights for the Magnavox Odyssey, which was the first commercial home video game console, which led to the company developing games, including Ever Race and Donkey Kong, and eventually its own game system, the Famicom, which shipped to Japanese consumers in 1983. Quite impressive. So, final question for today, and I thought this stupid thing worked, but apparently it doesn't. Apparently I have to go back to the trivia board, guys, and figure it out. If any of you know an easier system I could use to help plug in and play trivia, that'd be great. Let me know. So, final question of the day. See if you guys know your trivia. A platform upgrade involves swapping which core PC components? So if you're going to be upgrading your PC and you're going to do something called a platform upgrade, which core PC components does that usually involve? I'll give you a hint. It's three of them. But which three? Give you more seconds to type in the answers here. Octavius, you should really start yelling people. Actually, what you should start doing is you should start typing in the answer. Just don't tell anybody. And then when you get the answer right, you'll get the points. We'll see how that goes. Yeah, he's like, oh, I see all the answers here, so all I have to do is guess the right one. No, guess the wrong one sometimes, and then you won't have any difficulties. The correct answer for a platform upgrade is the CPU, RAM, and motherboard. Now, there are many ways to squeeze additional performance out of an aging PC. Swapping your hard drive for a solid-state drive or upgrading your graphic card might provide a speed boost depending on what you're doing. But changing out your CPU, RAM, and motherboard is classically recognized as a platform upgrade and is typically performed when a full rebuild isn't necessary, yet your Q6600 isn't quite cutting it anymore. So, that was all the trivia that we have for today. Sorry that the panel is not updating right. I'm going to snap you in half after the show. So, there you go. I threatened it. Ha! Ha! Got him! Okay. So, before we can move on to the tech news of today, we have to take a step back in time to before, technology was as well known as it is today. So, being that today is September 7th, 2018, let's take a look back, shall we? On this day in history, in 2005, the iPod Nano was introduced. On this day, Apple introduced the iPod Nano, effectively replacing the iPod Mini. The move surprised many in the industry, as the iPod Mini was extremely popular. However, the use of flash storage instead of a hard drive allowed for a much smaller form factor, increased reliability, and better battery life. These improvements proved extremely popular with consumers, as 1 million units were sold in the first 17 days. The pioneering use of flash storage in a consumer electronic device paved the way for its use in many future Apple product designs, such as the iPhone, iPad, and flash storage-based MacBooks. So, now you know your history, in case you didn't know that before, and now you do. Now, before we get on to the tech news for today, and I know all of you are looking forward to that, keep in mind that this show is brought to you by Tech News Gadget, and, over at Tech News Gadget, you can become an insider today for only $9.95 a month or $99 annually and help keep this show growing. Something to keep in mind, insiders get exclusive access to the daily video archives, along with their choice of an Octavius plush or insider's mug and more. You could actually, you see Octavius right there? You could actually get him, a clone of him, he told me clone, sent out to you. And right now, for a limited time, you can get a 10-day free trial of our monthly membership. No credit card required. Head on over to technewsgadget.net/insiders after the show to learn more. So, moving on to today's tech news. Let's load that up for you guys real quick. First on the docket, Google wants to kill the URL. Now, why in the world does Google want to do that? Well, first off, they're trying to do it in this latest update by deciding to remove the www dot before the whole domain name. And people are getting upset and confused and mad about that because not everybody has that capability, and it's quite frustrating in trying to figure out, how do I go to a website? I don't know why. Why are web pages so hard to use? It's really as simple as typing in technewsgadget.net in your browser. You hit enter and you go exactly where you want it to, or you tap enter if you're on a smartphone, a mobile device. It's not really that difficult. Heck, you don't even need to type in HTTP or HTTPS :// www dot. It's made it so much simpler. So everybody's all mad about that latest Google Chrome update. I think it was version 69 or 70, one of those two. But now, if you take a look at this article, well, Google wants to kill the URL. So let's dig in. Google's Chrome turned 10 yesterday, and Google has major plans for where to take the browser from here, including options that could revamp how we experience the internet at its most fundamental level, the URL. For the past few years, Google has been considering how to transform the Uniform Resource Locator System, something in case you didn't know before, that's what URL stands for, into something that scales more effectively with the modern web. In a conversation with Wired, Chrome's engineering manager noted the numerous downsides of URLs. And she said, people have a really hard time understanding URLs. They're hard to read. It's hard to know which part of them is supposed to be trusted. And in general, I don't think URLs are working as a good way to convey site identity. So we want to move toward a place where web identity is understandable by everyone. We know who they're talking to when they're using a website, and they can reason about whether they can trust them. But this means big changes in how and when Chrome displays URLs. We want to challenge how URLs should be displayed and question it as we're figuring out the right way to convey identity. So there's no doubt it's a fair point. Simple link obfuscation, which is making the text of a hyperlink appear to point to a destination site while the actual URL is something entirely different, is an easy way to launch attacks against users, including users who are generally on guard against these kind of attacks. And if we enthusiasts are kind of being honest here, we'll acknowledge that even those of us who know absolutely what not to do, we've accidentally clicked on a link we should have realized wasn't legitimate from time to time. But no matter how security minded you are, you've made a mistake. The idea of reforming the URL and something new coming out of it is a good idea, but it's also an idea that Google has been pushing on before. Remember back in 2014, the company rolled out changes to Chrome that turned URLs into what Google called origin chips, with the URL bar / search bar being dedicated entirely to search. So we have an image here that shows, instead of www.address.com here in the browser, it kind of showed it off to the left, and then you could actually search Google or type in the URL. Kind of a interesting chip experiment. Now, Google hasn't commented exactly on what feedback it received from the experiment, but whatever it got led it to move away from origin chips, and that particular feature really never made it out of Chrome beta releases. According to the author, they recognize that Google's concern about URL security and legitimacy are accurate. It seems disingenuous for their very company that helped turn URLs from simple links to sprawling aggregate lists stuffed with other data to pretend it played no part in fostering the very disaster it now wants to fix. Remember, there was a time when you didn't need to install browser extensions just to copy a URL out of Google Chrome without it being stuffed with a bunch of stuff that the end user really didn't need or value. That fact alone should raise eyebrows when Google declares it wants to improve the internet for the good of everyone, banishing those pesky URLs in the process. Now, if you know how to read them, URLs tell you a great deal about how data is being fed to publishers regarding your online activities. It's by no means everything. In fact, there's an ocean of other data also being passed along under the hood, but there's still value in being able to see and analyze what information when needed. So, URLs suck, obviously. They're unwieldy, they're confusing, they're inconvenient to communicate to people if you don't have a pen and paper handy, and good URLs that stick in your head the first time you hear them are kind of difficult to come by, mostly because they've already been purchased. The proliferation of domain extensions allows for tremendous flexibility, but also opens the door to copycat sites, squatters, phishers, and all manner of ne'er-do-wells. Google isn't wrong about these points. I don't think anyone particularly enjoys having to share short sort of links that transform into 4 pages of seemingly random code when pasted into a IM box. But, well, I don't think Google, of all companies, will come up with a genuine replacement scheme. And, well, we'll see. The companies that help break the existing system shouldn't be the ones in charge of fixing it. We'll see how it all turns out. So what do you guys think? Would it be easier if Google was able to play a part in reformatting how URLs work or shape or form? Remember back about 90s, late 90s, that URLs were numbers. So you had to know the proper number code to get to a certain website. But now you can just type in ilikeeatingtacos.com and go right to it. I don't know how that's so difficult. I don't know. I think probably breaking off the beginning part, the http://www. Would be a great start, because we don't really need that, because when we tell people to go places, we just say go here, you know, walmart.com for an example, amazon.com for an example, technewsgadget.com for another example. Sorry for the promo, but you know, to be fair, that's kind of expected. We don't say http or www beforehand. We kind of just ignore that whole part right now. But now, do we have to have the long continuing trail of data after it? I don't know. We'll see how it changes. So, moving on. Civilization 6 is coming to the Nintendo Switch, and this has been confirmed over at The Verge. By the way, the show notes for all the articles mentioned today, as well as all the past shows, can be found over at technewsgadget.net. Be sure to head on over there and check that out after the show. Today, 2K announced that Civilization 6 is coming to the portable console, and the game is due to launch on November 16th. The Switch version looks to be the full game, and it will even come bundled with some of the later additions to the game, including the Viking, Poland, Australia, and Persia, and Macedon content packs. It'll also feature co-op and competitive play for up to 4 people playing wirelessly. Now, Civilization 6 first launched back in 2016, and since then it's been steadily updated and improved. Late last year, it made a surprise appearance on an iPad, so kind of the Switch version really isn't a surprise here. Much like the recent reveal of Final Fantasy XV Pocket Edition for the Switch, today's announcement was likely due to be a part of this week's delayed Nintendo Direct event, which was postponed due to an earthquake in Japan earlier this week. So, seeing as how these publishers are like, guys, you're supposed to have the Nintendo Direct event this week. What's going on? We kind of have this news to get out. It has to be out now. Nintendo is like, hey, there's an earthquake in Japan. We're kind of taking a little bit of a break. So, news is leaking out. So, for those of you who like playing Civilization, hey, you can now buy it on the Switch. Moving on. Rockstar Game is revealing a new plot details for Red Dead Redemption 2. Now, for those of you interested in the game coming out, we kind of have a little bit of an interview here. Look at all that. Oh, nice, big, juicy article. So, Rockstar Games is saddling up to head back to the Old West when Red Dead Redemption 2 hits shelves next month. To follow up the 2010's massively successful Western, acts as a prequel set 12 years before the events of the original game and centers on the infamous Vanderlyn Gang. Josh Bass, art director at Rockstar San Diego, and Aaron Garbutt, a director of art at Rockstar North, caught up with the Hollywood Reporter to offer exclusive info about the hotly anticipated game and a gang of outlaws at the core of its story. So for those of you who have your popcorn and your drinks ready, let's dig in, shall we? Dutch's presence loomed over the original Red Dead Redemption, and his influence on events was a big inspiration for the setting and direction of Red Dead Redemption 2. We all wanted to know more about him and the gang. What was it like riding in that gang? What led them to the events of the original game? And what happened to them along the way? Fans of the original remember Dutch, the leader of his gang, as the primary antagonist in the story about the last days of the Wild West frontier. Other familiar faces crop up in the sequel as well, including John Martson, seen in this edition, well, this version, as a much younger member of the gang he will one day hunt down. In Red Dead Redemption 2, you get to see that gang, including Martson, at the peak of their notoriety and at the very moment things begin to fall apart. This story focuses on Arthur Morgan, Dutch's most trusted enforcer. Adopted by the gang by Dutch When he was a young boy, Arthur considers the gang to be his family. Dutch has given his life some much-needed purpose, and the gang has served as one positive and constant in Arthur's life. The central plot of the original game focuses on Martin's quest to hunt down his former gang members and stop Dutch from forming a new posse. While the new title focuses on the days when the gang was still in action, it isn't quite set in the heyday of the Lawless West. Things are changing. There's not much room in a rapidly modernizing world for the gang's way of life. Through Arthur's eyes, you see events begin to take a toll on the gang as they are forced to flee across America, while at the same time, Dutch's hold on the gang begins to slip. We've aimed to capture a wide slice of American life in 1899, a rapidly industrializing nation that would soon have its sights set on the world stage and would do whatever possible to modernize. It's a brutal landscape with a sordid history, but also one full of opportunity. One of the most satisfying aspects of creating a world of such scope and scale is the ability to experience a whole range of stories and characters in your journey across that world. The gang's journey and the game's epic scope makes room to touch on all aspects as turn-of-the-century America in a meaningful, substantial way. So, as it goes on, you'll see it's also talking about it. Oh, it looks like, oh, look, here's the whole gang. Dutch is in it. Arthur Morgan. Looks like Bill Williamson. Javier Escuela. John Martin. Charles Smith. Micah Bell, T.D. Adler, Say Matthews, Abigail Roberts, Uncle, Josiah Trelawney, Lenny Summers, Sean McGuire, Mary Beth Gaskill, Karen Jones, Tilly Jackson, Leopold Strauss, Reverend Swanson, Susan Grimshaw, Molly O'Shea, Pearson, and Jack Martin. Ooh, as a much younger Jack Martin. So, you can actually read this entire article because this is a exclusive. You'll certainly want to be able to check that out on the show notes for today, and don't want to miss out on that. So we'll have a link to that for the show. But yeah, more information coming out. For those of you looking forward to Red Dead Redemption 2, this is the news that you're looking for. Hey, let us know in the chat if you want to keep updated on this or any other stories, or head on over to Tech News Gadget on Twitter and let us know there. So moving on. Why Starlink might be the best Star Fox game in decades. And here's the funny thing, it's not even made by Nintendo. So for those of you who don't know, and you've been living under a rock for, like, ever, Starlink Battle for Atlas is coming. And obviously it was shown at E3. It actually, if for those of you who watched the trailer, it ended with a tease for a Nintendo crossover. There's a lot of this on the nostalgia, but for a lot of people, the impression was the game. Ubisoft's spacefaring Toys to Life game wasn't going to be a real Star Fox game, but it wasn't until the author here played the game for himself at a preview event just how true that prediction really was. Starlink Battle for Atlas isn't a follow-up to Nintendo's beloved space shooter. So far, it's better. Now, this article is getting me a little bit excited because many, many years ago, I remember playing Star Fox and having so much fun with that game. So I'm really, really hoping that this game is very much like that, if not better. So let's continue on. The author said, "This thought rattled around my head as I played a Nintendo Switch version of the game's opening moments. It's also on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. Flying Fox's A-ring spider through a field of asteroids, taking on an enemy squadron, and crash landing onto a planet of open-world exploration gameplay felt like fanboy sacrilege, but it also felt right. That's partially because of how deeply Star Fox was integrated into the Starlink universe. I expected to tie in to feel tacked on, like an extra piece of DLC that didn't quite sync up with the game's lore. Instead, I found a game that treated Nintendo's characters as an integral part of the story, naturally fitting into the game's opening cinematic, gameplay, and cutscenes as if they were always part of the ensemble cast. And to the extent that if you intentionally play the game with Fox, it feels less like a cameo and more like a full-on third-party Star Fox game. Matthew Rhodes, the game's producer, says it's intentional. It was important for us that it wasn't just a guest appearance. It wasn't just, well, here's a character you can play with, he said after the demo. Now, if you're going to invite Star Fox characters into Starlink, well, we wanted to do the utmost respect for that brand. Now, when they first appear in the game's opening cinematic, the Star Fox characters are conflicted over helping the cast of Starlink. Ever the hero, Fox wants to help people in need, but Peppy Hare wants to focus on their own mission, which is searching for Starwolf. It's dropped like a flimsy excuse for the cameo, but it's also a plot thread that keeps on returning. More and more I played, the more hints the game dropped. Fox and his crew investigating for hints about the rivals or talking with the Starlink crew about how to improve their fighters to get the upper hand, all the while integrating themselves into the narrative of this completely different open-world space exploration adventure. My time with the game was short, but when I stepped away, I couldn't help but wonder if Ubisoft had created a more engrossing Star Fox story than Nintendo ever had. Although, to be fair, I never did play Star Fox Adventures, according to the author. Now, that alone wasn't impressive, but it wouldn't matter if the game itself fell flat. It kind of doesn't. Now, with or without Star Fox, exploring the planets of the Atlas system is genuinely fun, with unique creatures wandering the landscape, gorgeous vistas to take in, and dozens of missions scattered across each planet's surface. Starlink's producers like to say that the game benefits from Ubisoft's experience of making complex open-world games like Assassin's Creed and Far Cry. It's a bold claim to make of a toys-to-life game, but at least during the early demo, it's holding true. Probably because it doesn't play anything like toys-to-life games we've seen before. Starlink may be an all-ages experience, but it surpasses the tropes of the toy genre. It doesn't feel like a kid's game. It feels like an open-world adventure with giant planets to explore and an abundance of branching side quests. The gameplay is fairly complex, especially for a game targeted toward a younger audience, challenging players to master on-the-ground tank-like gameplay, atmospheric flight, and free-range space combat. The result is kind of a game that sheds the baggage of Disney Infinity, Skylanders, and LEGO Dimensions and offers one that is a hybrid between space combat and open-world adventure games. But Starlink's Fox features have a glaring weakness. They're limited to the Switch. Moving to the Xbox One version, and the game felt lacking. The visuals were kicked up a notch, and the modular transforming ships were still fun to play with, but suddenly the game felt like it was missing something. Gone was the banter between Falco and Fox. Slippy no longer talked with Starlink's crew about how to improve the A-ring. Ubisoft's integrated Nintendo's characters into the game so well, the game almost felt incomplete without them. Starlink may be designed to stand its own as a new franchise, but it seems that there's much more to do in Nintendo Switch version of the game. So it might not be a Nintendo-developed Star Fox game, but if you play it on the Switch, it can be something a Star Fox game has never been. A big open-world adventure with complex stories, modular, customizable spaceships, and divergent gameplay. A Star Fox game, finally. New ideas. So, there you go. For those of you excited about the new Star Fox game coming up, more power to you. I'm excited. So, moving on. The next article is comes to us from Ars Technica, and Fortnite, congratulations, by the way, you've reached 15 million Android downloads without Google Play. Now, minus the security hurdles and problems of it dealing at launch there, you did it. 15 million downloads. In bringing Fortnite to Android this summer, Epic gambled that the biggest video game phenomenon in the world could find success without relying on the centralized Google Play platform, and its 30% cut of all demand revenues, because, to be fair, they kind of wanted some of that money back. That gamble seems to have paid off so far. Epic is reporting 15 million Fortnite downloads and 23 million players on Android just 21 days after the game's beta release. Now, keep in context, the iOS version of the game saw roughly 11 million installations in its first month, and though the first 2 weeks of that period were a more limited closed beta type, it took the iOS version of Fortnite about 3 months to reach 100 million downloads. Now, obviously, there were some technical hurdles. They released it to a small set of handsets in the last 2 years, and despite the fact that most Android Fortnite players are running Android 8 or newer. Despite working with up-to-date software, the Fortnite team ran into more headaches managing their fragmented hardware universe on Android. Memory management was chief among these problems. Epic found that even freshly restarted phones only allowed 50 to 75% of their total memory to be allocated by the game. That was probably by design. Apps running in the background could cause persistent memory headaches too, especially since some of those apps would automatically restart after Android tried to reclaim their memory footprints. Such memory issues on 4GB phones were behind the lagging, stuttering performance we initially saw on tests with the Galaxy S8. Now, Epic says it also ran into bugs in the early Vulkan API drivers supported by some recent Android phones, making OpenGL faster than Vulkan on most devices. The industry have had a decade to optimize and harden their implementations of OpenGL. Vulkan is a more complex API and will take some time to reach the same level of maturity. So, There you have it. Congratulations, Fortnite, on $15 billion. You guys look at these numbers and you go, oh, that's big. But if you look at it, that's like a lot of, that's a lot. And seeing as how if they say 15 million, and now we say, that 30% chunk that would have been taken out by Google, put into your store, which was how much? Ow. That's how much money they are now taking back in, minus the processing cost, which really isn't much. But yeah, look at that. Now they can finally keep the development going, keep the R&D going, fix the bugs on the Android, get the laggy-less version or smoother gameplay features and everything else integrated with it so that it all works out properly the way that it's supposed to, and the crossplay functionalities and everything works like a charm, because you can't do this if you don't make any money off of it. So great job, guys. And your final news for today, and I know you're super excited to hear about this for those of you Fortnite players. I'm not making this up, okay? When I show you this, you'll laugh, but it's not a gag. This is actually real. So let's see. Last article is Fortnite Monopoly is coming this October. Yep. For those of you who don't want to play the actual game itself, well, you can now play it on a Monopoly board game. man. So just keep in mind, guys, that tie-ins are nothing new for Fortnite. After all, Avengers Infinity Wars Thanos was in the game just a few months ago for Monopoly. But this game is now moving into the physical space with the Fortnite Monopoly board game. Epic Games Worldwide Creative Director Donald Mustard announced the game on Twitter. Fortnite Monopoly's final art included in the tweet shows off a familiar-looking Monopoly board with a few of the most recognizable locations from the Fortnite Battle Royale map. Areas like Paradise Palms, Dusty Divot, Lazy Links, and of course Tilted Towers are all spots on the map that players will have the chance to own. The game will also feature chests, traps, and storm cards to replace the familiar aspects of the normal Monopoly game. As for the game pieces, the game looks like it will feature plenty of the more popular skins for players to use, like Skull Trooper, Nevermore, and Omega. Fortnite Monopoly will be in stores on October 1st, according to Mustard's tweet. So, for those of you all excited, hey, you want to buy this merch? It is coming out. Should be in stores October 1st. Excited? About less than a month away. Perfect for the holiday season. And for those of you saying, I don't know what to get some of these people for Christmas, I don't. Maybe the Fortnite game would be a Monopoly game would be an idea or an option. To say, hey, you guys, stop playing on the computer or your smartphone all the time. Why don't you play an actual board game or socialize with people? Now you got your option. So that's all the news for today. If you happen to miss something on the show or there's something you want us to keep you informed on, hey, be sure to let us know. You can do that by letting us know in a chat or on Twitter at TechNewsGadget or via email at TechNewsGadget@gmail.com. Now, this show is a production of Tech News Gadget, so being that, as it may, I have to do a promo. Okay, we'll get through it really quick, and then we'll close out the show. Did you know that insiders experience, on average, 40% more happiness than the normal general population? You become an insider today for only $9.95 a month or $99 annually. You can keep this show growing. Also, you guys get exclusive access to the daily video archives of this show, along with your choice of an Octavius plush or Insider's mug, along with some other cool loot. Right now, for a limited time, you can get a 10-day free trial of our monthly membership. No credit card required. Head on over to technewsgadget.net/insiders after the show to learn more. Now, that will wrap it up for this episode in the Latest in Tech News podcast. Thank you guys so much for stopping by and taking some time to listen. I'm your host, Hale Merrick. For the latest in tech, gadget, and gaming news, be sure to head on over to technewsgadget.net. There you'll find the show notes, video, and more. Pretty much, keep being awesome, guys, and I'll see you on the flip side.